I don't suppose he was the right man for me anyways, fine spoken as he was. They don't look for him no more, but they might still hang him if they happen on him.
Dietrich hurried across the square to Butter Alley, where he vanished into the nest of streets that led to the Swabian Gate. At last he glanced behind him and saw that a boy had joined the fishwife. A dark-haired lad, of perhaps 12 years, lithe and well-muscled and dressed as a fisherman. Dietrich hesitated a moment longer, but though the boy spoke to his mother, he never lifted his gaze, and so Dietrich never saw his face. Over the next few days, as the market bustled, Dietrich avoided Münsterplatz. He arranged with a coppersmith to draw the ingot. "Provided," Dietrich told him, "you draw it fine enough to pass through this eye," and he held up a device that the crank had given him. The smith whistled.
"The gauge is surpassing fine, but naturally the finer the draw, the less copper I use, so I certainly have the motive."
He laughed a little sharply. Behind him, his apprentice sat on a swing with the drawing pliers in his hand, watching his master negotiate. "When will it be done?"
"I must draw the wire in several reductions so it does not harden. You see, first I soften it with fire and hammer a bit of the material through a die hole. Then my apprentice grips it with the pliers and swings back and forth, pulling, with each swing, more wire through the hole. But I cannot draw it so fine as this all at once, or the strand will break."
Dietrich was not interested in the finer points of coppersmithing, so long as the breaks are not hammered together. The coppersmith studied the ingot with covert avarice.
200 shoes? 3 days.
In 3 days the market would end, and Dietrich could leave this town of prying eyes. "That pleases. I will be back in that time." He bespoke also a glazier on the cost of repairing the broken church windows, and secured a promise from the man to come up the mountain in the springtime.
"I hear you've got locusts up there," the glazier said. "Poor harvest. A fellow down from St. Blasian said he heard locusts all over the Katharinenberg."
The man thought a little more, then added with a wink,
"And he says the monks at St. Blasian drove off a demon, hideous-looking creature, broke into the storerooms to steal food. So the monks set a trap one night and repelled it with fire. The demon fled toward the Feldberg, but the monks burned down half their kitchen in the feet."
He tossed his head, laughing.
"Burned down half their kitchen! You folks live near the Feldberg. You didn't see the creature come to nest, did you?"
Dietrich shook his head. "No, we did not see that." The glazier winked.
"I think the monks were celebrating the wine harvest. I've seen plenty of demons that way myself."
When the market ended, the wagons departed for the Hochwald with bags of coin, bolts of cloth, and a satisfied smile on Everard's face. Dietrich did not go with them, for the coppersmith's promise had proven optimistic.
"It just wants a different draw," the man insisted. "The gauge is so fine that it keeps breaking."
It was a plea to accept a thicker wire, but Dietrich would not hear it. He misliked tarrying, yet without the wire the Kränken would stay forever, and he had had a vision of what that would mean.
"They might still hang him if they happen on him."
He stayed in the chapter house at the Minster, dining with Willy and the others, but he never left by the south doors, and he never ventured toward the river Dreisam, where the fishermen's huts lined the autumn-starved floe. He prayed for the woman, and for her boy, and for her man, if she had found a new one. And he prayed that he might at least remember her name. Now and then he wondered if he had mistaken a fishwife's ribald jape. It had all happened somewhere else. It had all fallen into a shambles under the walls of Strasbourg, trampled under the hooves of the Alsatian chivalry, far from the Breisgau. It asked too much of coincidence that she be here. It demanded too much cruelty of God. The wire was at last ready on the commemoration of Perminius of Reichenau, and Dietrich departed with a party of miners bound for the Orchest, accompanying them until their roads diverged and he took the northern route to Kirchgartner Valley. There he found a caravan from Basel, led by a Jew named Samuel de Medina in the employ of Duke Albrecht.
Dietrich thought de Medina oily and arrogant, but he had a large body of armed guards hired in Freiburg and commanded by a Habsburg captain with a writ of safe passage signed by Albrecht. Dietrich swallowed his pride and spoke to the Jew's steward, Eleazar Abolefia, who, like his master, spoke a Spanish corrupted by many words of Hebrew.
"I don't forbid you walking with us," the man said with an air of vexation, "but if you cannot maintain the pace, signor, we leave you behind."
The caravan set forth the next morning with a jingle of bits and groaning of wagon wheels. De Medina rode upon a jennet suited to his bulk, while Eleazar drove a wagon bearing a heavy oak casket. Two mounted men-at-arms rode ahead and another two behind the party. The remainder, all footmen, mixed with the other travelers, now and then glancing into the wagon bed.
The party included a Christian merchant from Basel, a factor for a Viennese salt trader, and one Ansgar of Denmark, who wore a pilgrim's cloak festooned with badges representing the shrines he had visited. He was returning to Denmark from Rome.
"The pest has all but destroyed the holy city," Ansgar told Dietrich. "We fled to the hills at the first sign. And heaven have mercy on us. Florence is devastated. Pisa."
"Bordeaux, too," said Eleazar from the top of the cart. "The pest appeared around the docks, and Major de Bascale set the district afire. That was," he counted fingers, "second day of September. But the fire burned down most of the city, including my master's warehouse. Also the Chateau de Lambrario, where the English stay. The Princess Joan was to wed our prince. She was already dead from the pest, I am told, but the fire consumed her body."
Dietrich and the pilgrims crossed themselves, and even the Jew looked unhappy, for the pest slew Christian, Jew, and Saracen with equal disregard.
"It has not come to the Swiss," Dietrich volunteered.
"No," said the Jew. "Basel was clean when we left. So was Zurich. Though that did not stop the town from expelling my people because they thought we might bring it."
"But," Dietrich said, shocked, "the Holy Father has twice condemned that belief."
Eleazar only shrugged. Dietrich dropped out of step with the wagon and found himself next to the Basler merchant, who was leading his Walachian horse.
"What the Jew won't tell you," the man murmured, "is that the Swiss have a confession. A Jew named Agamet admitted to poisoning the wells around Geneva. He and others had been sent out by the Kabbalists with secret instructions."
Dietrich wondered how much the story had been embellished in its travels from mouth to mouth. If Christendom possessed crankish far-talkers, the same story could be told to all, which might not ensure the truth, but would at least ensure that all heard the same lie. Did this Agamet affirm his confession afterward? The merchant shrugged.
"No, he denied everything, which proves he was lying. So he was tortured a second time, and afterward affirmed."
Dietrich shook his head.
"Such confessions are unconvincing."
The Basler remounted his gelding, and from that height asked,
"Are you then a Jew lover?"
Dietrich said nothing.
The danger was past, now that the bad air had been blown beyond Paris, but fear lingered in those towns that had been spared.
Panic fed on rumor, and the pyre fed on panic.
So caught up in his thoughts did Dietrich become, that not until he bumped into the back of the Danish pilgrim did he find the caravan halted and the supposed guards, joined by knights under the falcon banner, had encircled the caravan with drawn swords. On the ground, with his throat neatly slashed, lay their captain. Dietrich remembered that he had come with the Jews from Basel, while the other armsmen had been hired in Freiburg to guard the casket. The dead man wore the Habsburg eagle on his surcoat. But Dietrich had only that glance before he and the other captives were chivied like so many sheep up the trail to the gates of Falcon Rock.
10. November 1348, the commemoration of Florentius of Strasbourg. Pilgrim, merchant, priest, Jew were all one to the Herr von Falkenstein. His interest had lain entirely in the casket, but the possibility of individual ransoms added an extra pleasure to his coup, so he interviewed his prisoners one by one.
When it came Dietrich's turn, the guards marched him before the high seat and threw him before the hare with no great gentleness. Philip von Falkenstein was dark-complexioned, with hair that fell in ringlets to his shoulders. He wore an ankle-length dark-green dalmatic, cinched at the waist, and over that a brocaded surcoat bearing the falcon crest. He wore his beard narrow, and it seemed to Dietrich that his face had the pinched look of an empty man.